Thank you for choosing this ABC Radio National podcast. When it's finished, we'll have details on other informative and entertaining programs you may be interested in. But right now, here's your podcast.
Well, it's that voice in your head again. It's letting you know you're tuned to All in the Mind. It's saying this is ABC Radio National, and it wants you to feel welcome. She says her name is Natasha Mitchell. Now, some of us experience relatively benign voices in the head like this one, but for others, they can be a constant and disabling torment.
I think there's a big cultural fear of voice hearing in the West. If you go to more traditional cultures, voice hearing is a much more accepted experience, and generally people don't have a problem when they start hearing voices because there's a whole wealth of wisdom about how to live with voices. So if you go to rural India or parts of Africa, 40 or 50% of the population will hear voices and it's not seen as a problem. I think in our culture it is a very taboo experience. And so what we're trying to do is create understanding about these are experiences up to 10% of the population can have. You can learn to live with the experiences. You need safe, trusting allies to talk to about that experience. And you can build up your confidence and courage and not be a victim of those experiences and learn from them.
Dr. Rufus May is a clinical psychologist with the National Health Service in Bradford in the UK. For some, he takes an unorthodox approach, as you'll hear. It stems from his own experience of being hospitalised in a psych ward as an 18-year-old. Madness, he provocatively says, is when people choose to stop trying to understand you. Dr. May and other leading figures in the International Hearing Voices Network gathered at the Recovery from Psychosis Conference held in Perth this week. Controversially, they're challenging the mainstream medical orthodoxy that voices are a pathological symptom of schizophrenia with little psychological sense or meaning. Now, there is a real risk here, of course, of romanticising what can be a frightening experience for people at the height of psychosis. But my guests today are three people pushing the boundaries and encouraging people to enter a therapeutic dialogue with the voices in their head as part of their recovery process. Dr. Sandra Escher is co-founder of the Hearing Voices Movement with her longtime colleague at the University of Maastricht, Professor Marius Rom, and they've penned a book called Making Sense of Voices, a guide for professionals who work with voice hearers. And Dr. Dirk Corstens is a social psychiatrist and psychotherapist in Maastricht, who with Sandra, Rufus and others, has developed a therapeutic approach to working with voices. Dr. Rufus May, Dr. Dirk Corstens and Dr. Sandra Escher, welcome to Australia. Thanks for joining us on ABC Radio National.
Thanks for being here.
Dr. Sandra Escher, you're a co-founder of what's called an international movement, really, the Hearing Voices Movement. What prompted the formation of that movement over 20 years ago now?
Well, actually, it was a patient that Professor Rom had. I worked together with Professor Rom, and his patient didn't agree with the way he treated her. He didn't want to talk about her voices, and it took nearly 2 years to persuade him to take a different attitude. And from that way on, we started to work. We found that it was revealing, and we got a lot of contact of people who were so happy that they could talk about their voices, and then we started to develop a way to approach it and to make sense to the experience.
I mean, 20 years ago, this was a direct challenge to mainstream medicine's thinking about the origin and meaning of voices, or they're called auditory hallucinations in clinical speak. I mean, it still is a challenge, as you point out. What was the core challenge at the beginning?
To let people accept that the voices were real, and that you could use the experience to build up a knowledge and to use it in therapy if needed, because 2% of the normal people hear voices and they don't need the therapy, but the people who need therapy, we learned that their voices should be used. What is important that people start to develop themselves voices stop the development, and if they learn to have a different attitude, they start to develop themselves again.
Rufus May, I want to come to your experience in just a moment, but what was the challenge that the Hearing Voices movement presented to mainstream medicine or psychiatry?
Well, hearing voices has always been seen as a symptom of schizophrenia, a biological disease, and that the experiences in the last 100 years have been seen as a meaningless thing that must be stopped or silenced with strong medication. And what the Hearing Voices movement was saying, no, actually, these experiences can be meaningful, they can be messengers about the person's life, and you can actually learn from them, but you've got to accept them and work with them rather than work against them. So it was a completely different way of thinking, really, to sort of invite the voices in rather than try and push them away or silence them with numbing levels of medication. Because medication can be helpful in calming emotions down in the short term, but if you're just using it as a cosh, it's not going to be helpful. It's going to slow the person down and not allow them to develop and learn from their experiences.
But Rufus, and perhaps to you all, on what basis do you claim that we should listen to the content of voices as a meaningful and interpretable experience rather than a symptom of, say, schizophrenia?
We learned that over years. I think I've interviewed about 350 people hearing voices. Through the interview, they learned the message of the voices. So it's the people who give the proof. It helps them to learn to live their lives again as they wanted it. People who are afraid of this approach, they see it as that we are very much against the medical model. But what we do is challenge the medical model to take one step further.
What Maris Rom and Sandra Escher did was interviewed voice hearers, and they compared people who were coping with the experience with people who weren't coping. And the people who were coping very often had some kind of understanding with their voices. They were able to set limits to their voices. They were talking to their voices. And the people who weren't coping were more afraid of their voices, didn't want to talk about the experience. And we've learned over the last 20 years with self-help groups how people can move from that group that are not coping to the group that are coping by learning to talk about their experiences, have a dialogue, confront the experience.
You know, what the problem is that in psychiatry, mostly people come who can't cope. So psychiatrists only meet people who are powerless, and all their knowledge is based on a small group that can't cope.
You really speak of, and I'm interested in how you conceive of the voices in your own work, because you really speak of them as a rational player. And what do you think voices actually are?
One way to describe them is subpersonalities. They might be representing difficult relationships a person has had in the past. So if you've had a really strict headmaster who caned you a lot, you might hear his voice. Another way to describe them is as emotions. They might be representing emotions that you've cut yourself off from because they're too painful to look at. Another way to look at them is as kind of dream beings, beings from the unconscious who are telling us, have got messages about our emotions. There are different ways to describe voices, but I would see them as part of our psychology.
You come to this discussion with your own experience, and some have described your approach now as a fairly maverick approach as a clinical psychologist. But take us back to your own experience at age 18 in 1986. What happened to you?
Well, I'd had some difficult adolescent years. I wasn't very happy at school. My mother had been quite ill. And then about 18, after my first girlfriend left me, instead of getting depressed, I sort of escaped into a fantasy world where I was a spy. I had lots of experiences like the radio talking to me, giving me special messages, and developed a lot of ideas about being involved in a battle between good and evil. And those ideas eventually became quite overwhelming, and I wasn't sleeping, and I got quite anxious, and obviously my family thought, you're behaving very strangely. So they asked for help, and I ended up getting hospitalized and given a diagnosis of schizophrenia and given strong medication. So that was my initiation into the world of mental health. And what I found was that people weren't listening to my experiences. They were just trying to sort of silence them with medication.
What was that experience of being hospitalized at 18 like?
It was very frightening. It was frightening for a lot of my friends, and they didn't want to come and see me. It was a real sense of powerlessness, having your freedom taken away from you, so you weren't allowed to leave. But no one was actually trying to sit with you and make sense of what was going on. You were just being observed. So you felt alienated. The best I could do was try and survive. So I developed quite a mad laugh to make myself seem more dangerous than I was, because other people seem quite dangerous in there because they're older than me and bigger and stronger and tougher. So I pretended to be more mad than I was to get by, which was great for surviving in hospital, but it wasn't very good for adjusting back to community living.
Absolutely.
Or trying to get a job. So I was caught a bit in the system for a while.
Did you hear voices?
I did hear voices from the TV and radio speaking to me and reflecting my thoughts, but I didn't hear disembodied voices that were constantly talking to me like many people I help do.
But what you were experiencing, well, for psychiatrists, a classic symptom of schizophrenia, delusions, the sense that objects are talking to you, have messages just for you. And yet you today think very differently about that diagnosis you received, don't you?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think it was one way of coping with a depressing situation. I just didn't find it helpful to be told I had a biological disease, I'd always have to take medication, just to believe that I'd, having some experiences, could learn from them. They could become a source of wisdom, not something to be ashamed of. And I believed that I could recover, get on with my life, and that I developed a mission, really, to get back into the mental health system. So I don't think I had schizophrenia. I don't think anyone has schizophrenia. I think people who have unusual experiences that are kind of dissociative reactions to difficult life experiences. So I think schizophrenia is a bit of a, creates misunderstanding. So there's a whole movement to try and get rid of the label of schizophrenia.
And also the message that's given, lifelong illness, lifelong medication.
Yeah, because you can become a schizophrenic. It can become a lifelong role.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a very radical thing you're saying for the mainstream, that schizophrenia is in effect a non-existent entity. And yet there's a huge body of research in neurobiology, in genetics, in psychiatry, dedicated to probing, to understanding what many would consider as a heritable biological illness.
Well, there you say something also that's not true. It's not heritable. They're doing research, but they haven't proven it yet.
The British Psychological Society produced a report back in 2000 with all the top psychologists contributing to that report. And back then they were saying we need to move away from the diagnosis of schizophrenia. If you carefully look at the scientific evidence, it doesn't tell us anything definite about the cause of people's experiences, the content of their experiences, or the outcome. The three things the diagnosis should tell you about. So in England, in many academic circles, it's not seen as radical to not use schizophrenia. And the international...
Yeah, Americans are more fond of it.
Yeah. The country is more influenced by a drug company.
Yeah.
Doctors Rufus May, Sandra Escher and Dirk Corstens are my guests today in Australia this week for the Recovery from Psychosis Conference in Perth, all key figures in what's called the Hearing Voices Network, an international collective of people who hear voices or are researchers and clinicians who believe that these voices are meaningful, not simply medical symptoms to be medicated away. It's a position many argue is perhaps irresponsible. Others find it a relief. This is All in the Mind on ABC Radio National, going global on Radio Australia and as podcast with me, Natasha Mitchell. Dr. Dirk Corstens, can I come to you? Together with Dr. Rufus May, you've developed a therapeutic approach that involves people dialoguing with the voices in their head. What's the principle here?
The principle is that we consist of several sub-personalities, and from that on we discovered we could talk with these voices, and we found out that most voices we talk with display whole characteristics of personalities, of knowledge that people contain about their life history, why these voices came. In our perspective, many voices try to protect people's emotions for, in their lives, dangerous situations.
Dirk, you talk about working with people to explore the motives of the voices, and also about developing a more productive relationship between the voices and the voice hearer. It really sounds like you're treating the voices as a real entity, almost another person.
Yeah, that's right. When I talk to voice hearers, I talk to several persons. And these voices interfere in our communication. And they have their own opinions and things they want.
Often living with voices as like living with a wife or a husband that you don't get on with. It's a bit like marriage in the 1950s.
It's being married without divorce as an option.
So you need to learn how to make peace with that,
yeah,
that partner.
Dirk, take us then inside a session where you're getting someone to dialogue with a voice, because, you know, there's a very real risk of romanticising the experience of internal voices. I mean, people with schizophrenia or with the diagnosis of schizophrenia experience these voices as often vicious, constant, intensely disabling. They can tell a person to harm themselves, to harm other people, that they're worthless. It's an intensely disabling and unsettling experience. So, Dirk, how do you work with that situation?
Well, one good example is that, let's call him Fred, came to me and he heard one voice telling him to kill himself, to jump before a train. When I just had a conversation with this voice, and this voice started very angry also at me, but after a while told me that Fred was a very anxious guy. And this voice wanted Fred to stand up for himself, become stronger and more fearful. So in this conversation, I asked this voice if he thought that his attitude towards Fred helped or not. And he said, no, it doesn't help because Fred is more anxious instead of more stronger. We discussed about how this voice could help Fred to become stronger.
You're actually sitting down with a person,
yeah,
and you are talking to both that person and their representations of the voices in their head, which they're experiencing, yeah, during the session.
Yeah.
But I have one thing to say. You assume that all voices are negative. About 45% of the voice hearers also hear positive voices. And that's one of the problems, that the media mostly talk only about aggressive, negative
voices. Well, it's not just the media that talks about this. I mean, I've met lots of people with schizophrenia.
Yeah,
who had terrible
question
experiences of the voices,
yes,
in their,
sure,
head.
Sure,
yes,
sure.
But it's more diverse than you say.
But we're not glamorizing the experience. We teach people to interpret the voices symbolically. So if a voice is telling someone to hurt someone else, we'll look at what's the symbolic meaning of that. Are you angry about something? Do you need to learn assertiveness to stick up for your rights more? But obviously not to literally respond to the voices and do what the voices are saying. So we're teaching people to, a bit like dream analysis, if you have a nightmare, it's telling you about some repressed fear or anger, and you need to process that. So that's what we're doing by helping people face those difficult voices.
Rufus, so are you actually presenting an overlay, a set of symbols, in the way that a Freudian or Jungian analyst might do, or are you letting the person make their own meaning of the voices? What's the theoretical principle here?
Well, we're doing it together. So if somebody's got a voice that bullies them and tells them what to do, I would suggest to the person, well, have you ever been bullied? Let's talk about that. It's common sense, really, but it's working together.
And we don't start immediately with relating to the voices. First, we want to learn to know the person and his or her history. And we found that often in 70%, the voices relate to what happened in people's life history. So, in our opinion, these voices are reactions at things that are happening in people's lives.
What sorts of experiences, Dirk? And you certainly use an interesting interviewing instrument, don't you, that's a little different,
yeah,
from what a psychiatrist might generally use when they're sitting down with a client.
Yeah. So the interview is about characteristics of the voices. Who are they? Do they have a name? Many voices have a name. Does the voice resemble somebody you have known or know? We ask for the characteristics of the voices. What are they telling you? How do they sound? Do they yell or do they whisper? And the most important thing, I think, is when did the voice start?
Mm.
And often we find that the voices started in a moment in their lives where people were overwhelmed by emotions. Voices, in our opinion, are dealing with emotions that the person himself can't cope with. And we try to change the relationship between voice and voice hearer.
Do you want to eliminate the voices? Because for many,
no,
people, that's what they want to do. They want to have them removed.
But that's an illusion. That's a dream. That's, I think, the critical point about our discussion with medical model-oriented psychiatry. They want to silence voices, but with the medication, only a part of voice hearers' voices are silenced. Only one third of the people hearing voices. Our hospitals are full of people who hear voices, who still hear voices, although they get huge doses of medication.
Rufus May, do you advocate that people don't take medication so that you can work with them, with their voices?
That's an informed choice that the person makes. They can choose to use medication or not, and I'll support them with both choices.
Because I guess that one risk here is that people hearing your own story, and you did manage to get off medication, that people might feel, who, if they're benefiting from medication or they're feeling overpowered by their voices, that somehow they're a failure if they elect to take medication and not work with the voices.
You can do both. You can take medication and work with your voices, so the two aren't in opposition to each other. But where somebody thinks that the benefits of not taking medication may outweigh the benefits of taking medication, because sometimes there are big health risks with taking medication over a long period, the problems with weight gain, for example, with some of the new antipsychotics, and people want to try weaning themselves off, I'll support that. But it's not to say that it's a failure if you don't manage to stop taking medication. It's about lifestyle choice, and we all use substances and different activities to moderate our emotions and thoughts. I just want people to have more choice about how they do that, even with voice hearing or unusual beliefs.
Your suggestion is that some people can in fact learn to quite comfortably live with the presence of voices.
We're all saying that, yeah.
How so?
Yeah.
Well, that we've just got lots of experience.
Yes.
We know hundreds of people doing that, living with voice hearing, not taking medication. It can
also
be done.
Also, the research shows that only a minority of voice hearers become our patients, and the majority of voice hearers can cope with their voices.
Dr. Sandra Escher, the focus of some of your work and research interest is, in fact, working with children and their experience of hearing voices. Mm-hmm. Is that a common experience for children?
There's a taboo on voice hearing, so it's difficult to say how many, but some research shows about 8% of the children hear voices, and only a small percentage needs care. About 85% of the children started to hear voices after some traumatic event or circumstances they couldn't cope with.
What sorts of events and traumas might trigger voices in young children? Because you've interviewed children as young as 8 or 9 who have experienced voices.
Yeah. About a third of them had problems in school with the capacity to learn. They found the school too difficult. They couldn't cope with that. There's a group of 19 children started to hear voices in grieving process when the grandmother died or a friend died. And there's some children who started to hear voices in long physical illness, divorce. There were 6 children who started to hear voices in the divorce process of the children.
This is in a sample of 80 children that you studied some years ago.
Yeah.
We're talking about something quite different to, say, the internal dialogue that some small children have with an imaginary friend, aren't we?
Yes. Therefore, my research started with children from 8 years on, because with 8 years, a child must be able to make a distinction between fantasy and reality.
What were you trying to investigate with them, this group of 80 children that you looked at who were experiencing voices?
Well, we wanted to see if it was a continuous phenomenon, because the idea is that once hearing voices, you always hear voices. And 60% of the children lost their voices within the 3-year research period. That's one of the things. The thing is, they have no language for it, so they first have to develop a language for their experiences. We saw that if the children learned to cope with the problems, also the voices changed. They learned better to cope with emotions related to problems. And what we saw, which was very important, that we normalized the experience. That helps parents also to be able to talk with the children about the experiences and learn to find ways to cope with it.
Because this is very distressing for parents, isn't it?
What I mostly do when I get into contact with parents, I say, hey, calm down, because if you're afraid, your anxiety is going to your child, so don't make it worse.
And your suggestion is that voices in children don't always warrant a diagnosis of schizophrenia.
Oh, no, definitely not. Mostly not. Don't get overexcited. Don't start on medication immediately. Go and look where the problems are.
The trouble with giving a young person a diagnosis of schizophrenia is that they can often then give up on the idea that they can live a full life. And voices can often get more scary once people are given a diagnosis of schizophrenia, because the person is fearing the experience more, and voices respond to that.
Totally agree. You take away hope, and I think that's one of the things that people need, hope. All the stories of people that we met prove that you can give hope.
I guess stories are one thing, but people would be demanding good clinical evidence here, wouldn't they, Rufus? And where are the randomised, placebo-controlled clinical trials? Where's the evidence that this therapeutic paradigm has good outcomes?
Yeah, well, there's a lot of evidence for psychological therapies working with psychosis, and we're starting to develop research into the approaches we're talking about, but obviously people are really benefiting from them already within self-help groups. They're difficult to research because by their very nature, they're very independent. They don't like researchers coming in, a bit like Alcoholics Anonymous groups wouldn't like researchers coming in and studying them. There's a kind of lived experience evidence base that's emerging that's more about emancipation than about an evidence base from a randomized control trials, because randomized control trials were designed to measure drugs, not to measure people's holistic recoveries.
Rufus, I have to ask, I mean, some people have considered your own approach with clients or patients or people in need as quite unorthodox, quite maverick, and even dangerous.
That was a journalist who said that.
I wonder though, is it suitable for everyone to dialogue with their voices in the way that you're advocating and developing? Or are some people simply not suited to this?
Dialoguing only works with people who hear voices that respond to them. Some voices will refuse to actually acknowledge the person and respond to their thoughts, so they will carry on a commentary but not have an actual dialogue with the person. So you can't, it's very difficult to get a dialogue with voices like that. So you need other approaches like distraction or the person building up their self-esteem so they're not bothered by these voices. But I find my approach is very popular amongst people I work with in Bradford. And Maverick, the original Maverick, he refused to brand his cattle, so he was independent-minded. So I don't mind that side of being Maverick, as long as I'm not considered reckless. You know, I think my approach is very safe because it's all based on building good relationships with the people I work with.
People are scared of this approach, though, aren't they? Family members will say that they experience a lot of fear and a lot of distress with family members electing not to take their medication and experiencing psychotic symptoms that are very distressing to themselves and their family. So there's a lot of risk in this conversation for people, isn't there?
Well, I found that therapists are more afraid than the people themselves.
Yeah, biological psychiatrists are very afraid of this approach, and so drug companies, because they want to just treat it in one way. And we're saying we need to have a much more holistic approach.
And we don't advise people to stop their medication.
No.
We try to find other ways, but many, many patients still take their medication and can cope with their voices.
You know, there are people who are forbidden. If you talk about your voices in hospital and they give you more medication, you stop talking about your voices. But it doesn't mean that the voices are away. The voices are still in your head. So what we do is get in the open with it and learn about it.
The scary thing is when you're isolated with an experience, if you've got friends and family who you can talk to about the experience and share ideas about a way to cope with it, half the problem is gone already.
Well, it's difficult for us to bring out the nuances and complexities of this whole discussion in just a half-hour program. I do appreciate you coming on the show, Sandra Escher, Dirk Corstens and Rufus May. Thank you for joining me on All in the Mind.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
And my guest, with some radical words for some, from their collaborative work, Dr. Dirk Corstens, a psychotherapist from Maastricht, Dr. Rufus May, a clinical psychologist from West Yorkshire, and Dr. Sandra Escher, co-founder of the Hearing Voices Movement. She's based at the University of Maastricht. And I've popped links and more info up on our website, abc.net.au/rn/allinthemind. And this being a topic that always divides, I fully expect your comments in my All in the Mind blog too. Always welcome, or via email on our website, which is where you'll also find the downloadable audio and transcript. Thanks to producer Kyla Brettel, studio engineer Russell Thompson. I'm Natasha Mitchell. Next week, kicking off a series with curious tales from the history vaults of psychology. You'll love it. Catch you then. We'll be right back.
We know that behind Fair Trade Coffee, there's a very elaborate and trustworthy system of workers' rights, of ethical farming. So this is similar in that we need the label on that media in order to determine what kind of media we might be using.
Ethics Online. Can we develop a stamp of approval? Find out on the Media Report. Download or stream this program from the Radio National website.